Views and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and contributors, and not necessarily those of WFSU Public Media.
What's the 411? You're tuned in to 411 Teen, a weekly program for teens, families, parents, educators, and other interested folks. 411 Teen provides a forum to examine and discuss various issues and events that confront, intersect, and sometimes interrupt our daily lives. I'm Dr. Liz Holyfield, and joining me this hour via Zoom platform, I welcome Dr. William Keyes. Dr. William Keyes explores the transformative power of mentorship, drawing from his book, The Stories They Hear, and his leadership of the Institute for Responsible Citizenship. The program aims to inspire educators, mentors, and community leaders to invest in young talent and create lasting generational impact. The Institute has shaped the lives of more than 300 young African-American men, including Fulbright and Rhodes scholars and leaders in various fields, exploring the principles of mentorship, leadership with purpose, and building resistance. Dr. William Keyes, welcome to 411 Teen. I'm so glad to have you.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
The Institute for Responsible Citizenship prepares young African-American men to be exemplary citizens and leaders through an intensive leadership development program. What inspired you to establish the Institute for Responsible Citizenship? And I think that was founded in 2003?
Yes. Okay. Thanks for asking me that question. I'm asked it all the time, and I should have a pat answer that I give everyone, but there are many reasons. I think the biggest one is just that I had observed that there were many very talented young African-American men who had the potential to do some pretty amazing things with their lives, but just were not being given the support that they needed to achieve it. And I wanted to bridge that gap. Years after I started the Institute, I was reading W.E.B. Du Bois, who in 1910, I guess that's what, a generation or two after the end of slavery, made the comment that as he was trying to build a system of higher education for Negroes, we'll go to philanthropists who would say, Du Bois, that's great, but the kind of people you want to help ought to be able to take care of themselves. Hmm. And I remember thinking, wow, a century later, I'm still dealing with the same thing. Where there's so many talented young people who are working hard, doing well, they're ambitious about being successful for reasons that are bigger than themselves. And in so many cases, we look at them and say, yeah, but they ought to be able to take care of themselves. And that's just tragic. And I feel like we miss out on a tremendous amount of talent that could be a blessing in so many people's lives because we have that attitude. That's the gap that I wanted to bridge. And fortunately, you know, 22 years into this program, what we've seen is that the investment in talented young people really does pay huge dividends.
Well, what do people look like? What do they look like if they ought to be able to take care of themselves? I'm a little bit confused. You know,
they're working hard. They're doing well. They're achieving some level of success. And from my standpoint, that's precisely when we ought to come alongside them and say, you know what? We want to invest in you to help you go even further.
Well, that's why I asked that, because, I mean, if they're doing well, you know, and we continue to support them and mentor them, I mean, I don't see. But anyhow, OK, that's another whole thing. I'm a little confused there, but that's great. Yeah.
Can I tell you a quick short story on that point? Probably my best friend is one of the leading spine surgeons in the Mid-Atlantic region, a brilliant and wonderful man, grew up in a tough neighborhood in Philadelphia. And he told me about growing up there, and there was this group of kids in his neighborhood who were just always getting into trouble. They were doing all kinds of things, were not even paying attention to school. And there was this organization in the community that decided that they were going to do something to help those kids. And so they organized a trip to Colorado for these kids to be able to go hike the mountains. And I'm guessing it must have been something like an Upward Bound program, though my friend didn't name it. And my friend said, you know, those kids are always in trouble. I've never been anywhere near any trouble. I've never made a grade other than an A, but they get rewarded with a trip to Colorado. He says, I've never seen those mountains, but, you know, they get rewarded for their behavior. And I'm sure that organization wasn't thinking about it as rewarding them. But my friend was sitting there at home, you know, thinking, so why am I working so hard? Why am I working hard to make straight A's? Why am I working hard to be a doctor who's going to treat thousands of patients and make a difference in their lives when the people who get all the attention are the folks who are the exact opposite of me? And he told me that story as a way of saying, I get what you're doing with the Institute. You know, that's what Du Bois was dealing with. The young people like my friend Ron, you know, are being ignored while other people are getting all of the attention. Now, I am not saying that we should ignore the other kids. I am not saying that. So if anyone says that Bill Key said that, they're lying on me. I'm not saying that at all. But what a tragedy. If the people who are working hard and doing well, and like I said, for reasons that are bigger than themselves, what a tragedy if we're not supporting them to help them be successful.
And, you know, the other kids were getting rewarded. I mean, for their behavior. I mean, yeah, just a sidebar there. They are getting a reward for it. Well, share the overview of the program's goals. And I know you have five core beliefs, and I read those, and I'd like for us to go over those. But if you would share the overview of the program's goals and the structure, and then we can get into the five core beliefs.
Sure. So first and foremost, it's for African-American male college students. These are young men who attend colleges all over the country. They're interested in a wide variety of fields. They have different majors. They come from different backgrounds. I mean, it is, other than the fact that they are all African-American men, it is a very, very diverse group, very competitive. Our biggest applicant pool, this is not typical, but our biggest applicant pool was 640 applications for 12 spaces. So that year, I remember telling the young men who we admitted, it was harder for you to get into Princeton or Harvard or Michigan or North Carolina or wherever you go to school. It was harder for you to get into this institute than it was for you to get into that program. So hopefully you appreciate it. And of course they do. So we select 12 young men who spend two summers with us in Washington. They live together on a in a university residence hall. They do internships during the day in whatever fields they're interested in, whether it's ministry, law, politics, journalism, you name it, business.
Do the arts? You include the arts?
We do the arts.
Okay.
And in fact, you know, we have a couple of folks who have said that they were interested in the arts and they learned about opportunities in the arts when they came to the Institute, which really changed their lives. But anyway, so all of those fields, in fact, you mentioned the arts. This class that we just selected, for the first time, we selected a young man who's interested in becoming a chef.
Oh,
you know, he wants
really?
To become a chef and own restaurants. And I'm convinced he's going to be one of the big name chefs that you hear about and see on television and all of that. But, you know, some people think that it's Washington, D.C., and everybody who comes here wants to do law, politics, those things.
Yeah.
We just want young men who are going to make a difference in the world. And as you and I know, you can have influence regardless of what career career you end up in. So they do internships during the day. We arrange great internships for them. In the evenings, they do some academic seminars. They do economic and constitutional principles. They also do ethical principles. We think it's really important that they really focus on the subject of ethics. They meet privately with all kinds of people. For the first I guess, 19 years of the Institute. Every year they met with General Colin Powell, Congressman John Lewis, but really high-powered people who sadly we lost over the last couple of years. But still, they're going to meet with the Secretary of Defense, members of Congress, corporate CEOs, but really high-level engagements with high-level people. Professional development workshops. We don't take anything for granted. You and I know that someone can be brilliant, but if they have no manners, they're That's probably not going to go as far as their talent would mm-hmm. take them. Mm-hmm. What else do we do? There's, you know, we do all of those things. But at the end of the day, when people ask me what's different about the Institute, what's really different is that we get bright people around the dinner table at the end of each day. Mm-hmm. And we have conversations, and those conversations are where we have a chance to really challenge assumptions that people make that may not be, you know, in my opinion, very good assumptions. But we go deep, you know, and we're able, because there are 12 juniors, 12 seniors, 24 people around that table, we can be really honest with each other. I say this is a safe space, mm-hmm. not like the safe space that some people mean, you know, on their college campuses where they mean they want to be safe from hearing you say what you believe. Mm-hmm. No, this is a safe space where people are, you know, not only have the opportunity, but in what I tell them is they have the obligation to say what they honestly believe. Now, everybody else is not obligated to agree with you, but they will treat you and your ideas with respect. And I believe that if we're having those open and honest conversations, we might get to the bottom of some of these very serious problems that these young men are concerned about. Wow. So we have those conversations, and those conversations really are the difference between what we do and what most other people do. And so after 20 years, I decided to write those conversations down. And that's where the title comes from, the stories they hear, the stories they hear. And so when you want to talk about expectations, expecting greatness, how is that transmitted? It's transmitted through those stories. When we talk about being honorable men, I call them, you know, I refer to them as the best and the brightest. And I always say, listen, I refer to you in the best as best and brightest, but never forget the fact that best comes before brightest. I care far more about what kind of human being you are than what's on your transcript. How do you communicate that? You communicate that with conversations around the dinner table, with stories. And so I can't invite all of your 411 teen, you know, listeners to come sit at our dinner table, but I can share that those conversations by writing it down in this book for them to read.
Hold your thoughts. You're tuned in to 411 Teen. We're going to take a brief break, and we will get back to the conversation with Dr. William Keyes. Just tuning in, the program is 411 Teen. I am talking with Dr. William A. Keyes. And Dr. Keyes, we had to take a break, but was there anything else you wanted to add about the best and the brightest? I mean, it sounds like such a dynamic program. I know the Institute was founded on five core beliefs. And when you can, I'd like to ask that you share those core beliefs with our audience.
Okay. One thing that I would say, though, is I do want to emphasize the point that I was making before we went to break.
Okay.
And that is, I really do care about what kind of human beings these young men, these young men are. Mm-hmm. And, you know, one of the things about it is, by the way, I hope during that break, 100 people went online to Barnes & Noble or wherever they buy books and ordered this book. If they can remember my last name, K-E-Y-E-S, the stories they hear, I would love it if they buy this book and read it. And also, if they have young people, high school, college age, or even young adults, that they encourage them, maybe they give them to them as gifts, to read these, because they're stories that are designed to help these young people be successful in their lives, in their schools, in their careers. And I think that transcends just African-American male college students. It's for Black, white, Asian, Latino, men, women, across the board. I think that these stories are really universal and can be really helpful.
Well, I read the book, and I love the chapters. I love the titles of the chapters because I think that gives it away. It tells you what it's about and where you're coming from and what is necessary.
Can I put you on the spot and ask you if there's any one particular thing that resonated with you?
I have to think about it for a while. I like the story. I like all the stories because I thought they really sent a message. And I have to think about it, but I did. I'll think and come back. How's about that? How is that? Okay.
Sure. One of the things about it is that they are short. They're short chapters.
Yes, they were very short.
Yeah, and that's because, you know, they're short. The conversations are long, but if I sit down with these young men, I'll say, all right, gentlemen, this is what I want to talk to you about tonight.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of it's storytelling. And as I enjoy saying to them, I'll just say, listen, you know, some of these stories are real stories, things that I've experienced. And some of them are fictitious. The good news is I'm going to tell you the difference. But nonetheless, you know, hopefully, you know, when you read these stories, you really do come away with a sense of what it is that's causing us to end up with people who are, you know, a member of the New York State Supreme Court, a surgeon at Johns Hopkins Hospital, a professor at Duke University. You just go down the list, partners at top law firms in the country. They're doing some pretty daggone remarkable things. And, you know, one of the things that really has led to this success that they're having is that they bought into a certain set of ideas and principles that have shaped their shape the way they view the world and that they go about their business in the world.
Well, you know, as we're speaking, I think I mix a lot of them together, but I know there was a John Black and a John White, and they both were the same. They both looked the same on paper, okay? But their environments were different and their exposures were different, if I'm remembering it correctly. I think
you're exactly right. And that really forms
that
the basis. Yeah, that story really forms the basis of why we do what we do.
Mm-hmm.
We talked about it a little earlier. You know, those two young men basically have the same profile.
Right.
You're exactly right.
Yeah.
And John White, and this is a fictitious story, by the way, but I'm sure this has happened a million times. And John White, you know, just for your listeners, you know, give a kind of a short version of it. You know, John White's dad is driving down the street and he sees, one of John White's neighbors is driving down the street, sees John White's dad walking down the driveway and he pulls over and he says, "You must be so proud of little Johnny." And they have this conversation and he asks, "So what's he thinking about?" And they talk about where he wants to go to college and when he's going to apply and why he wants to study what he wants to study and all of those things. And what comes from that conversation are all kinds of benefits for little John. Mm-hmm. The neighbor says, "Oh, well, you're going to go visit that school. Well, I've got a friend who's on the faculty there. I should introduce you." You know, that faculty member ends up becoming a huge resource for little Johnny. The neighbor says, "Well, what's he doing for the summer?" And the dad says, "You know, he wants to study business. He wants to run a company one day. He shouldn't be lifeguarding. He should be interning for me at the company where I work, and I'll introduce him to everyone." But anyway, we go through this long list of all these benefits that little John White gets simply because there are people in his environment who say he's working hard and doing well, and I want to support him. And then, you know, when I'm telling this story, I'll say, okay, now, let's talk about John Black. Mm-hmm. And then I pause. And at the end of a little silence, I say, you know, we don't need to talk about John Black. He'll be fine. That is the tragedy so many talented young Black men endure. Okay. It's that they are being asked to compete against people who are getting all kinds of support, and they're not getting that support themselves. we created the Institute for that very purpose, to be able to say, if John White is going to get a great internship, we're going to make sure John Black gets a great internship. If John White is being introduced to people who can be influential in his life and his career, we're going to make sure John Black is introduced to people who can be influential in his life and career, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And like I said, the proof is in the pudding. When we have provided that kind of support for talented young men, they become members, you know, at age 30 or whatever, of the New York State Supreme Court. They're doing all these amazing things. They have the ability. What they need is the support. And so, thanks for sharing. That's one of the stories that you like.
Yeah, I like that. Would you talk about the core beliefs? Because I want the audience to hear them.
Do you have them in front of you?
I think I have some of them. Like, for example, men with the greatest potential should be challenged to pursue the highest achievement. Is that one?
Yes.
Okay.
That's one. Just to talk about that one for a second. This is hard. What we're doing at the Institute is hard. And during the admissions process, I will tell our applicants, this is not summer camp. So don't think you're going to come to Washington and just kind of lay around and have fun for 8 weeks at our expense, by the way. Uh-huh. This is really hard. We're expecting you to go to your internship during the day and work as hard or harder than anybody else in that place. We're expecting you to come back to the office in the evenings and do these seminars and work harder in these seminars than you do in the classes that you're taking back on your university campus. I'm looking at my computer and I see a picture of General Colin Powell with all the guys. When you go meet with Colin Powell, you're not going to see him to be entertained. You're going to engage him in a high level discussion, which means you have to prepare. So anyway, we're challenging them to work hard, but in pursuit of the highest goals. So think about it this way. What is impact? So a lot of times people say, well, Bill, you're only working with 12 young men at a time. Wow. Yes, but 12 young men who are going to make a huge difference in the world. The one who's a New York State Supreme Court justice, we didn't just invest in him. We invested in all of the people of the state of New York when we invested in him. Mm-hmm. The young man who's a surgeon at Johns Hopkins, it's not just an investment in him. It's an investment in all of those patients that he will treat over the course of his career and all of the people that his patients will influence. So this is really, really huge. And so we're pushing them to pursue their highest goals, objectives, abilities, because it's not just about them. It's about all the other people who will benefit from their success.
And that kind of ties into one of the other challenges where you were saying that men who strive to make a difference can have a greater impact by working together. I like that one.
Mm-hmm. You know, one of the really great things about the Institute is that I have really brilliant young men who come to the Institute, and at some point they'll say, you know, Dr. Keyes, this is the first time in my life that I've been surrounded by other young men like myself. Mm. And I used to be shocked by that. Mm-hmm. And then over time, I realized this is really true. You know, there are a lot of young men who want to talk about who won the Super Bowl or who's going to win the NBA championship or any number of other things. But these guys are leaving my office and then going back to their residence hall and sitting up until 2 o'clock in the morning debating some of the things that General Colin Powell told them. Or whatever, it is an entirely different experience. And so then you end up in a situation where someone comes to the Institute, is working as hard as he can to be successful because he's part of a network of people who are working hard to be successful. And they support each other, right? And it's, you know what's really wonderful? It's there's no competition, but they're all supporting each other. Mm-hmm. I'll never forget when our first Institute alum was named a Rhodes Scholar. Mm. And the email went out that Rakeem Brooks was named a Rhodes Scholar. And then whatever number of institute alumni we had at the time, let's say 100, my phone and computer just ping, 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 with one man after another saying, congratulations, congratulations, congratulations. And that was just a really, really beautiful thing that they realized that if one of us becomes a Rhodes Scholar, that reflects favorably on all of us. And guess what? Five more young men after that became Rhodes Scholars. So I have five directly in the Institute, but six proteges, young African-American men who have become Rhodes Scholars. You probably don't know this, but there's no institution in America, not Princeton, not Morehouse, not any fraternity, that has more Black African-American male Rhodes Scholars than the Institute. Isn't that
very
remarkable?
Yes, it's
isn't
very
it?
Impressive.
And it's not that it's a competition, but the point is something's working.
Yeah,
that's what this book is all about, that I want to share with other people what it is we're doing. What are the conversations we're having? What are these young men being exposed to? What are they thinking about? That's what's in this book. And like I said earlier, I think this applies universally, whether it's young white women or little older Black men. I think it applies to so many.
Well, let's talk about the student participation. I mean, how do you identify your scholars? If somebody may be listening and may, you know, pique their interest and maybe they'd like to apply, I mean, what is the process?
Sure. So we blast information out to colleges and universities around the country every year and encourage them to share with their talented young men this opportunity. And we get a bunch of applications in. The application deadline is January 15th every year. And we get a ton of applications in. We go through those applications very carefully. We interview the best candidates, and frankly, for most of them, we'll do follow-up calls, you know, letting you in on a little secret here. People think that you do the interview and that's that, but we're probably going to pick up the phone and call you randomly when you're not expecting it and have another conversation with you and then maybe another, because we want to get to know these young men as best we can to make the best decisions we can make. And so then,
what are you looking for, though? I mean, how? Because you have so many applicants.
Yeah,
I'm just trying to get a feel for, you know, who should
apply. I'm gonna give you an unsatisfying answer, and that is, I can't tell you that, but we know it when we see it.
So
I'm looking for a young man who's working hard in school. Okay. You can't tell me that you want to be a U.S. Supreme Court justice one day, but you don't have grades that are good enough to get you in the law. So you got to have the grades, right? Now, by the way, as an aside, I also tell them when they come to the Institute is, all right, now put your transcripts aside, right? Because everybody here has got top grades at great schools. Put that aside. Now there are other things that we're working on. But anyway, they have to be smart. They have to demonstrate that through their success in their courses at school. We like people who are engaged on campus, not just book nerds who are sitting in the library all the time, but maybe they're involved in a ministry on campus or a social program on campus or in the community, you know, around the campus, where they're really demonstrating that they want to, that they're concerned about the lives of other people. That's what we're really investing in. They have to be decent writers, because they've got to write compelling essays that say why it is that they're worthy of this major investment that we're making in them. And we should talk about that investment. But you know what? Here's the thing that I tell people all the time. They also have to be likable. And nobody tells them that in school. All right.
Yeah,
so all of the people
true.
Who are listening to your program,
yes.
they're probably hearing this for the first time. Mm-hmm. You can be as smart as you want to be, but if nobody likes you, you're still going nowhere.
Right.
And so then the question is, what does it mean to be likable? And we actually have conversations about that. One example is, you're probably going to be a whole lot more likable if you demonstrate that you genuinely care about other people. If you're only concerned about yourself, who's going to like you?
These
are the kinds of conversations, frank, basic, down-to-earth conversations that we're having around our dinner table. But we want people, I say all the time, We've already established that you're smart. We're established that you're hardworking. We're established all of those things. Now, what is the last thing I want to know? The last thing I want to know is how badly do you want to be a part of this program? But that's also another way of answering the question of, do we like you? Because we want people, we like people who can see the value of what we're doing and want to be a part of this and take advantage of it.
Wow. Now, you also have a high school program, correct?
We used to.
Okay,
we used
you to, don't have it. Okay.
But we discontinued the high school program, and instead what we did was to establish programs for college students, because that's really where we have we feel we have the greatest impact. For college students in other cities around the country that have multiple colleges, and that program operates on Saturdays through the academic year. Okay. So that's what we're doing, you know, aside from our flagship program during the summer here in Washington.
What challenges did you face in while building this institute? How did you overcome them? I mean, you have been so successful. I think folks listening could just even benefit from some of the experiences you had, even getting to that point where you had the institute, where you opened it, where you founded it.
You know, that is a really interesting question. We don't have time to really go through it, but I will tell you this. You know, when I was these young men's age, my goal in life was to become a college football coach. And this is, I write about this
Let me interrupt you right now. Let us take a break so you can continue the your story without us interrupting. You're tuned into 411 Teen. This is such an exciting program. I'm really enjoying it. I'm talking with Dr. William Keyes. We're going to take a brief break, but we'll get right back at you.
Views and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and contributors, and not necessarily those of WFSU Public Media.
This edition of 411 Teen highlights Dr. William Keyes, his recent book, The Stories They Hear, and the Institute for Responsible Citizenship. Dr. Keyes, you've got the floor.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah.
So we were talking about this crazy career of mine. When I was in college, my goal was to become a college football coach. And I was obsessive about it. I read every book about it. I went to conferences. I would even just show up at different colleges and stand on their sidelines and watch how their coaches operated, their practices and everything else. I was 100% all in on becoming a college football coach. Mm-hmm. I was sitting in a political science class one day and just got so excited listening to one of the lectures that I decided that I was going to slam on brakes and make a sharp turn, and no longer was I going to pursue becoming a college football coach. I wanted to do politics. Left school, went to work on a U.S. Senate campaign, and was 100% all in. When that campaign ended, by the way, the gentleman who I worked for was not successful, but I guess me being me, I decided, well, just because he's not moving to Washington doesn't mean I can't. So I literally hitchhiked to Washington, D.C., with $5 in my pocket.
God.
Now, I tell this story. Don't do as I did.
Okay.
But I hitchhiked to Washington with $5 in my pocket and got a job working on Capitol Hill. And that's a whole story in and of itself, because I had none of the requisite, qualifications to get a job on the Hill, but I did. 4 years after that, I ended up working as a senior policy advisor to the president of the United States. That makes no sense at all. But I was 100% all in on doing politics. At some point, I was burnt out on politics, and I decided, once again, slam on brakes and figure out what else do I want to do. Ended up selling life insurance. I worked for a company that had 11,000 agents, and I ranked number 32 out of 11,000.
Mm, wow.
And I didn't know anything about selling life insurance, but I worked hard. That's how it went. So at some point, I recharged my battery and I said, okay, no more. I need to get back to politics, which is my real love. And I ended up doing consulting, public policy consulting. Did that. You know, once again, I'm going 100 miles an hour, working my butt off doing that. And I was recruited to run a program at Georgetown, which I wasn't really open to. But then after I talked to three people about that same job, thought, you know what? I do love working with young people. There's a lot to this that seems interesting. And I took the job at Georgetown, which I did for 4 years. But during that period, I saw the power of a program like this. And that's where the idea germinated for me to create a program explicitly for African-American men. And that's where this came about. So I talked to my scholars about this. I tell them this story all the time to say, at your age, you're probably not going to end up doing what you think you're doing now. You know, your life takes turns and all of that. Very few people are going to say, I'm going to do X, and that's what they end up spending their lives doing. But whatever it is that you think you should be doing, I want you to go 100 miles an hour toward that goal. And when that changes, you go 100 miles an hour toward the other goal. And I say to them, if you look at my background, it looks like I've done several random things. They look random to us, but they're not at all random to God. And God had me in all of those different roles because they were the perfect preparation for me to do what I'm doing now. And that's pretty daggone exciting for me. And that's my prayer for all of these young men, for all of the young people who are influenced by 411 Teen, that somehow they, wherever they are, whatever stage they are in life, that they will go after whatever it is that they're interested in right now with all the gusto, even though that might change. Because the more they learn about selling life insurance or coaching college football or whatever it is, the more you learn while you're pursuing those things, the more you have to bring to bear when you get to your ultimate destination, whatever that might be. So I hope that answers the question you asked.
And I think it answers this one, but I'm going to still pose it because they may have something you want to add. What do you hope that readers take away from your book?
Wow, there's so much in there.
I know.
I mean, I don't know how many pages there are. I've got a book in front of me. Let's see here. There's about, you know, almost 300 pages. There's a lot in there, and I hope that they'll take away a lot. And here's the beautiful thing. What they take away is going to be different for every single person who reads the book. For one person, they're going to be surprised by my insistence on hard work. We've actually expelled four young men from the Institute over the last 22 years. Two of those four people, I kicked them out because they weren't working hard enough. You know, you don't reach the top. See, these young men understand it when it comes to football and basketball, but nobody's really getting them to understand it when it comes to medicine, business, ministry, all of those fields, which, you know, even though I'm the world's biggest sports fan, all of these other things are frankly far more important. And we're not giving them or instilling in them the kind of work ethic that it causes them to want to work really, really hard to be successful at those fields. Hard work. And we're insistent upon it. And I think some people who read this book might be shocked. Let me tell you another really quick story that's not in the book. That when I took that job at Georgetown that I just mentioned, I hired a young man to be my assistant and for the summer. And I worked him really, really, really hard. I mean, I was almost embarrassed at how hard I made him work. And at the end of that summer, as he was leaving, he told me that his mother and his aunt were coming to town to pick him up, and they would love to meet me. And I thought, oh my God, this boy's mother is going to stab me with a knife when she's heard how hard I've been on him. And we went out to lunch. And at some point during the lunch, the young man, his name was Brendan. Brendan said, excuse me, I need to go out to the car to get something. And he left. And when he walked out, his mother turned to me and she said, thank you so much for what you did for Brendan this summer. Mm. What you did for him is more than we can describe. And she's got tears in her eyes as she was telling me this. And I'm now about to tear up, you know, listening to what she has to say. And Brendan comes back into the restaurant from the car, and they have all of these gifts that they brought. And so here's a situation where I'm thinking, man, did I work this kid too hard? And the reality is, and now we're talking about, what, 25 years later, this young man is still a dear friend who will say how much difference it made in his life that I was willing to push him. So think about this, you know, and this applies to everybody, but I'm focused on young Black men. Think about this. They're on a college campus. Oh, let me tell you a different story that's also not in the book.
Okay.
So I was asked to come visit a large Midwestern university. I'm not going to name it. And they said, we'd love to have you come out and observe and tell us why our African-American male students are not doing so well. And I went out to see them. And a couple of days after I'd been there, we had breakfast with the provost and, you know, a group of faculty members and deans. And they said, okay. And I said, I think I know why your young men are not doing so well. And they said, well, why? You know, they perked up. And I said, these young men are living up to your low expectations. And they were shocked. I said, you're not pushing them to work hard. They see that. And this one woman said, well, I'm afraid that if I push them to work too hard, it will drive them away. And I said, well, you have a football team, right? And they said, of course. I said, you think your football coach makes his players work hard? And they said, of course. I said, okay, you have a basketball team. Same thing, right? I said, so let me ask you something. Why do you believe that if you push a young Black man to work hard for physical pursuits, he will thrive in that environment. But if you push him to work hard for intellectual pursuits, you'll drive him away. Mm-hmm. And I was just silent. And I let them squirm in that silence. Because if there's anything that's racist, in my opinion, it is assuming that these young men can go out and just work on those fields.
Right.
But if you just push them just a little bit in the classroom, it will, as this woman said, quote, drive them away.
Yeah.
That's horrible. Mm. So when you come to the Institute, you're going to work hard, but they're going to work hard because the idea is that they're working hard to achieve something that's going to make a difference in the world.
Wow. That's powerful.
So when people read that, you know, I think we put it into a context. We're not going to kill anybody, but we want them to know working hard. Here's another one. Can I tell you another quick one?
Sure.
They might be surprised by this one. So 1937, I guess it was, when Napoleon Hill wrote, anything the mind of man can conceive, he can achieve. I ask these young men this all the time. Do you believe that? And everybody says yes. And I tell them, I don't believe that in a million years. Anything my mind can conceive, I can achieve. Mm. Well, if that's the case, I'm going to stop running this institute. I'm going to go off and hire a golf pro, and I'm going to become a professional golfer. Because I can convince myself that I can do it, does that really mean I can do it? So therefore, it seems to me there's something else we ought to be telling young people. And that is that God has blessed you with something special. Mm-hmm. If you buy this book, those are the first words you're going to read, because it's the first thing I say to them at orientation. It's the first thing I say to them at their graduation. And it's something that I say to them several times in between, and then several times after that. God's blessed you with something special. I think God blessed me with the ability to work with these young men and prepare them to be great. And if I squander that ability that he's given me, which I think he's given me in good measure, to go out and chase being a professional golfer, then, or what if God has blessed you with the ability to go out and become a really, really great surgeon, right? Mm-hmm. But instead of doing that, you pursue law, which is also a, you know, an honest, you know, admirable career, but you pursue this other thing. Why? Because Uncle John is a lawyer, or because your daddy told you when you were a kid, you know, I think you would be a great lawyer when you grow up, and ignore the fact that you may have been blessed with other gifts? Are you really going to achieve what you have the potential to achieve? Those are the kinds of things that we talk about. So how does a young man or a young woman really get in touch with what it is that's special about them so that they can pursue the right fields? That's something that we talk about in this book.
Wow. It's very impressive. Can we talk a little bit about the mentorship? I mean, what are the common misconceptions about mentorship and its role in shaping young leaders? And I think you've talked about it, just even the assuming. But is there anything else?
Listen, I'm gonna sound like a jerk when I tell you this, but I don't mind.
Oh, okay.
Way too many people think that they can pat a kid on the back and say, you know what, you're great, Johnny. You're just a great kid. Mm-hmm. And Johnny knows he's not great.
Mm-hmm.
Johnny knows he's a C student, right?
Right.
Well, if C is great, what the heck is an A student, right? But you act like you're going to pat him on the back and tell him how great he is, and that's going to influence him to actually be great. It doesn't. Mm-hmm. Maybe what we ought to do is say, Johnny, you have the potential to be great, but that takes a lot of work. And let me tell you what the benefits are if you put in that work and you become great. The benefits for you and the benefits for everybody around you. But just having those kinds of conversations. Right. Self-esteem. You know, I think there are three or four chapters in the book about self-esteem.
Yes.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
One of the chapters would say, you know, how do you build self-esteem? By tackling tough challenges and succeeding at them. Mm-hmm. But yet somehow people think being a mentor is just hanging around some kid and telling him how great he is when that kid knows he's not great. You're wasting your time.
Right?
But that kid is going to be great when you challenge him to do something big and help him achieve it, give him the support to achieve it. And then when he achieves it, he gets hooked on the idea of saying, I can take on tough challenges and succeed at them. What's another way that people develop high self-esteem? High self-esteem comes from the praise of people you respect. And so when someone like a General Colin Powell says to these guys every single year when they come to his conference room, I look forward to this day every year meeting with you guys. I really hope people will read that chapter in the book where it talks about him saying that to them and how one year Mrs. Powell showed up because she said, and I thought he was just saying it to be nice. She said, every year my husband says, guess who I met with today? The guys from the Institute came. And this morning, he says, oh, wow, look at my calendar. Guess who I'm meeting with? The guys from the Institute are coming. And she said, you know what? I decided I wanted to come down here and meet you guys for myself. That's pretty daggone powerful. You think that that helped their self-esteem when they had someone of his caliber to say to them, the best day of the year for me is the day I get to hang out with you guys. How about self-esteem comes from being a great person?
Yeah.
You know, it's not who makes the most money.
Right.
You know, there's some people who make a lot of money who are just miserable and have horrible self-esteem, right? But how about becoming a great person, which is the thing that's going to lift your self-esteem? How about living a virtuous life? How about being someone who's supportive of others? Those are the kinds of things that build self-esteem. And so you asked me about mentorship. And I think all of that is a part of it, is that if we're if we're being good mentors, we're helping to build their self-esteem so that they can go out and make a difference in the world. And there are some things that are self-esteem building, and there are some things that are just a waste of time. And unfortunately, I think a lot of really well-meaning people, well-meaning, good-hearted people are doing and saying things that are not really achieving what they want to achieve.
Wow. You have to come back. Will you come back? I mean, I have a ton of questions I'd love to ask and just hear you talk about. I mean, I'd like to have you talk about the generational impact, but we are out of time. And so I want to say how much I really appreciate you. Special thanks to Dr. William Keyes for sharing your time and your expertise. But it's time out for this edition of 411 Team. To my listening audience, much appreciation for the privilege of your ear and time. This is Dr. Liz Holyfield inviting you to tune in next week, same time, same place, to get the 411 on 411 Team. 411 Team was produced by Dr. Liz Holyfield. Technical assistance was provided by Evan Rossi. If you would like to participate in the 411 Team or have suggestions for discussion topics, call 850-645-7200. You can listen to previous episodes of 411 Team at wfsu.org.